This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
The only way that we can stop other cultures from trying to, in a sense, maybe outrank ours, is by re-establishing the importance of Christianity. It doesn't mean everyone should become Christian, and that's not the case, but by reinforcing the importance that as a British country, we follow predominantly the culture and values of Christianity, means that other cultures will know their place more within our society, will integrate into what we want rather than trying to get us to defect and change to what they want us to do.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast.
In this week's episode, we hear how a bizarre parish council mix-up has led to a £4,000 election. A special event was held in Medway to discuss the contentious issue of flags, and the Chancellor was in the county to talk about the Lower Thames crossing. I'm Simon Finlay, the local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Dan Essen, who reports on the borough and districts.
Hello.
And Robert Boddy, who covers Medway Council.
Hello.
And Nikki White, senior news editor, who's going to be having a look at the national picture.
Hello.
Our special guest today is Amelia Randall, who represents the UK Independence Party on KCC. First up, Dan, what have you been looking at this week?
So I actually spent much of the last week getting to grips with a clerical error at Birchington Parish Council in Fennet. Not just any paperwork blunder, though. This one's ended up costing a few grand and is leading to an election.
Wow, how did they manage that? That sounds intriguing.
So back in May 2023, Birchington Parish Council was elected in normal fashion. However, before that election, a decision was apparently wrongly taken to remove the words North and South from the names of the two wards which formed the parish council. As such, all 10 members were technically elected to represent only the one ward for the whole parish. Nobody put any complaints in or the like noticing this, so the election was perfectly legally valid until recently.
So what was the problem then?
Well, a few weeks ago, one councillor, Councillor Marcel Pook, resigned from Birchington Parish Council. When a councillor resigns, a district has to advertise the vacancy so that people can either petition for an election to that ward or so that somebody can be co-opted onto that seat. But the lawyers say that since the wards were wrongly deleted from the documentation the last time the whole council was elected, it's impossible for them to know which ward he resigned from and therefore impossible for them to advertise the vacancy. The council's law lawyers say that this is pretty much completely legally novel and that Fennet has no choice but to force a whole parish council election with the proper wards in place. Naturally, the existing parish councillors are not immensely pleased about this as they soon start setting a budget for next year and so on, but the district says there's no choice to be had in the matter. It's going to cost £4,500 or just under, but Fennet District Council tell me that the returning officer, the chief executive of the council, is going to personally cover half of the cost and the parish council will only have to cover the other half.
Robert, what's been happening at Medway?
The topic of flags has somewhat declined from its peak when lots were put up across the country, but as they're still flying on many lampposts around the towns and with more flag-based protests being seen, Reverend Nathan Ward of St Margaret's Church in Raynham hosted an event this week to discuss what the flag means and how people are feeling about it. Medway Council leader Vince Maple, Tory leader George Perfect and Reform's Chatham and Aylesford chairman Matt Johnson sat on a panel. Members of the public were able to give their views and then they asked a series of questions to the politicians.
Okay. What sort of things were being said? It's quite a contentious couple. Was it a heated discussion?
There was a real mix of views, and for the most part, people were respectful of one another, and there was support for people who supported the flags and those who said they felt uncomfortable because of what the intentions behind them might be. There were times when tensions rose, but the talk was very well moderated and things were quickly brought back onto the topic for discussion. A lot of people said the flags were expressing a dissatisfaction with the government. Some people said it was a response to a lack of community. Other people said it was reminiscent of the National Front in the 1970s and 80s and the 1930s and asked why it had come about now specifically. Others contested the idea it was a grassroots movement and said it was orchestrated by the far right. On the panel, Vince Maple defended the council's decision to start taking down the flags because it was breaking the law and caused problems for some motorists, which some members of the audience did agree with. He said he had no problem with the flag and supported people putting them up on their own homes. It was when they were forced onto public spaces shared by everyone that it became an issue. Matt Johnson, however, said Britain had suffered a persistent degradation of its culture and the flags were a way of fighting back for a Britain he said was, quote, under attack. He also said if someone felt anxiety about seeing these flags, they should question where their allegiances lie. This received a pretty strong negative response from some in the hall, but others did agree. All in all, people were able to put across their views, but I'm not sure how many people actually changed their minds.
So Simon, what's been happening in your way this week?
Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, was in Dartford on Monday to talk tough about streamlining the planning system. So what she wants to do, and what the government wants to do, is try and make it harder to mount legal challenges to big developments. And she was using the Lower Thames Crossing as an example of this. And she says under Labour, judicial reviews are going to be limited in number and will be presided over by judges with planning expertise. And this, she says, will get spades in the ground a lot quicker and help to unlock growth further and faster, I think she said. The Lower Thames Crossing, which, you know, links Gravesend to Essex under the Thames, was given the green light a few months ago, and survey work has already started, and it's likely to cost about 10 billion quid.
So I understand that Gravesham MP Lauren Sullivan is using the Lower Thames Crossing to campaign for her patch.
Yeah, Dr Sullivan's making a pitch for a slice of the toll money once it's built, and it should be pumped into running the Gravesend to Tilbury ferry, which, you know, came to an end quite recently. And although officially the service is suspended, it's essentially halted for good. But it stopped when Thurrock Council was forced to withdraw its subsidy, and Kent County Council, which is also under a lot of financial strain at the minute, couldn't make up the shortfall. Although they were getting passenger fares from about 1,000 people who were using the service in the last year, it amounted to a chunk of the revenue, but it was well short of what was actually required to keep it running. So Dr Sullivan has been lobbying the Chancellor of the Exchequer to secure a slice of the cash from the tolls. When we asked her about this on Monday, Rachel Reeves did not say that Lauren has got her cash, but crucially she also didn't say that she hasn't got it. So Mrs. Reeves made the point that there should be community benefit to the communities hosting these major infrastructure projects. However, local businesses took the view that 2034, which is when the crossing is due to be finished, is too long to wait. The loss of the service has already been an impact on the town that see almost all of its prestige retail outlets such as M&S already move from the town. So we'll have to wait and see how this all pans out. Nikki, what have our MPs been up to this week?
So I've been looking at a story reporter Brad Harper's been following about a rally taking place in Kent this week opposing Operation Brock.
So what's that all about then? Who's organising that?
So most people in Kent will know all about Operation Brock, as they've either been caught up in it, suffered the fallout as a result of the diversions, or they've simply had to change their travel plans to avoid it. For those few people who don't know what it is, it's a contraflow system on the M20, which was first introduced as a Brexit traffic management plan to be used in the event of disruption at the Port of Dover and Eurotunnel. The scheme creates a contraflow system on the motorway, filtering off HGVs travelling towards the port on the coastbound stretch. Then all other traffic is directed onto the London-bound side, with a temporary barrier dividing the carriageway and a 50-mile-an-hour speed limit is brought in. It's brought in at times when there's likely to be an increase in tourist traffic, such as in the school holidays, but it also often leads to gridlock around Maidstone, Ashford and the surrounding villages, particularly those on the A20. And many people, both those who live in the surrounding areas and motorists, have just had enough.
Okay, and so there's now a rally.
Yeah, it's being led by MP Helen Whateley, who represents Faversham, and it will take place at Maidstone Services on Friday, and that's happening between 11:30 a.m. and midday. Now, she's calling for urgent action to end the system and find an alternative. She says that Operation Brock is simply snarling up Kent, and it isn't the answer the authorities think to the queues at Dover, and enough is enough. She said when it's activated, the M20 just becomes a lorry park, and businesses are losing trade, families are left sitting in endless queues, and people were quite rightly very angry. And it's costly too. I mean, every time Brock is deployed, it costs about £250,000, and just the maintenance and servicing costs are another £100,000 per week. Ahead of the rally, Helen's due to meet with the Kent and Medway Resilience Forum. That's a partnership of various organisations and agencies which help communities prepare and deal with emergencies. And she's going to try and meet them, as well as KCC and parish councillors. She's urging them to look for a long-term alternative, and is suggesting something like a mini Brock system just between junctions 7 and 8 as a temporary fix.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
One of the fresh crop of 57 Reform UK councillors elected in the landslide victory at County Hall was Amelia Randall, but less than 5 months after her election, she became one of the first to defect. to UKIP, and Amelia is here to tell us why. Hello, Amelia.
Hi.
Amelia, listen, thanks for taking time out to speak to us today. It's been quite an autumn for defections one way and another, but before we get into all of that, how did you get into politics?
I have always had an interest in politics, and I think predominantly it was all about how can I make the world a better place for my boys when I became a mum. And obviously it's a bit dramatic getting into politics, so I kind of waited and waited. And then when COVID hit, that was my kind of turning point. It's where I realised that I needed to actually now look into it more and have a say myself and try to determine how politics was going to be moving forwards.
When you stood in May, did you expect to win your Birchington and Rural division?
I was quite confident. I know from the general election that we did quite well in this part of the constituency. Yeah, so right. Yes, I was quite happy with that.
From your limited time within Reform's ranks, would you say it was a unified party at Cardi Hall?
There's definitely some clear differences. But I think at times we definitely do try to be unified.
You're kind of hinting that it wasn't massively unified.
Well, in all circumstances, when you've got a big group of people together, you're going to find that not everybody sees eye to eye all of the time. And yes, there's definitely times when there are clear differences, and it's just, I think, more hopeful that we become, or they become, more unified moving forwards.
Was there a problem with the sort of the people at the top?
I mean, you can see straight away none of them have previous experience. And when I look at a leader, I look for someone who, okay, even if you haven't got experience yourself, how do you use and utilise those around you that do have experience? And if you look at how the council's been set up, who's got what positions, you will quite clearly see that a lot of the experienced councillors that were elected have been placed on the backbench. So that to me says a lot about the mindset of those that are leading, and that actually there are things that, in my opinion, definitely could be done differently.
Okay. Can I assume from that that was one of the reasons why you defected from Reform to UKIP? Now, got to say that UKIP is a very different party from the time that Nigel Farage was once its leader. And
definitely,
it takes a much more, well, it's a hard right, let's call it a hard right party, strong on immigration or anti-immigration and strong on its Christian themes. Why did you decide to defect to UKIP?
I mean, obviously there's a few reasons. From the perspective of why I left Reform, that obviously came into it. You know, I wasn't happy with where we were identifying as a party anymore. You know, we've campaigned hard that we're going to be this party of change, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, in reality, we weren't really doing that or bringing that to the table yet. So, you know, more and more that became frustrating. And the party itself, the Reform that I knew, was changing its identity into what I didn't want it to be and how, what I believe the majority of people voting for us don't want it to be. And then when it comes to UKIP itself, UKIP is a very different style of party in some respects, because we have a leader who is very determined, very set in his mind, and isn't someone who's going to, should we say, flip-flop? I think that's the word that most people tend to use. He isn't going to bend his views on things. So he's the kind of person that will stand by what he says, and is very similar to Reform in the sense of, you know, is fighting for the things that I feel are important, like immigration. So it was, in the end, it was quite a clear decision that UKIP would stand for what I think we were, in some respects, standing for at some point, and would deliver on more definitely, if that makes sense.
Dan, so you want to come in there?
A lot of people say, obviously, you were elected as a Reform councillor. People voted for the Reform Party, not for UKIP. So a lot of people say you should, you know, if you want to renew your mandate legitimately, you should resign and call a by-election. What do you think of that argument?
There's different ways of looking at it, but the way I look at it is Reform were a big part of my life for 3 years. In fact, I have an emotional ties to Reform. If anyone had even suggested I would leave, I would have told you a year ago, absolutely not. I would have laughed at you. It was a huge decision for me on a personal level, on an emotional level, to even consider leaving. So the fact that I've done it because I believe that we were not giving the people what they voted for. It wasn't because I you know, I've had people come to me and say, you know, you should call a by-election because people want reform. Well, we weren't given reform. If we were, we'd never in a million years have looked at another party. I can see that we're not providing what we said we were going to provide, and that that's only getting potentially worse depending on how the party moves nationally. So I was trying to give the people what they actually were voting for, even though the banner as such is a different name.
I've seen, I think, something you wrote online not too long ago saying that part of why you joined UKIP rather than Reform was because you think there should be an emphasis on Christian politics and Christian culture. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, so for me as well, the reason UKIP turned out to be the one that I defected to was because I think there are, in a sense, three main ingredients to saving our country, in my opinion. Stopping the boats is one of those. Of course, we all understand that that needs to happen. But Christianity is where, as a country, our values and our culture has been built from. The only way that we can stop other cultures from trying to, in a sense, maybe outrank ours, is by re-establishing the importance of Christianity. It doesn't mean everyone should become Christian, and that's not the case, but by reinforcing the importance that, as a British country, we follow predominantly the culture and values of Christianity, means that other cultures will know their place more within our society, will integrate into what we want rather than trying to get us to defect and change to what they want us to do. So that was the second, as I say, ingredient that I think we needed to actually safeguard our country and take our country back in the way that it needs to be.
But what would that actually mean in government, though? Because Britain is not a majority Christian country. It hasn't been for quite some time. The last census came out that Britain was majority secular. What does a Christian politics mean if it is not either restricting the freedom of other religious practice or directly promoting Christianity?
Everyone's entitled to have their own belief and to follow the religion that they wish to follow. I don't follow Christianity myself, although I have done in my past. I'm not actively following it. However, it's identifying the fact that within our laws, within the way that we treat people, within our culture and our values, mm-hmm. it's just reinforcing the fact that actually a Christian country is what we were built on. And it doesn't stop others from believing what they believe in, but it stops them trying to change us. Like, for instance, Sharia law. There's Sharia law courts and councils in London. That won't be a thing when you realise that by bringing that in, you are disrespecting what Christianity stands for. And if we are reinforcing Christianity in our country, we can push that aside and say, no, actually, you can't have that here in our country because that's not right for us. And until we can sort of push on that, it gives too much leeway to other people to try and push their culture on us, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but the church has been quite unhappy about how some of the hard right or far right movements have been adopting Christian symbols like the cross or whatever, sort of saying that, you know, perhaps feeling uncomfortable that what the message isn't terribly Christian, that, you know, you're prepared to sort of, you know, want to deport people or not show kindness to your fellow man isn't very Christian at all.
I think the only fair way to look at that is even within the Bible, when you read the Bible, when I can't quote directly off the top of my head, it kind of states that, yes, we should look after our neighbours and we should be there for them.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if someone has illegally entered the country and is not following the laws of that country, then they are going directly against what the Bible would suggest is the correct thing to do. So it's not that we're trying to be horrible to anyone, but we are just trying to say there are things in place that you need to follow. And also that there is a safety aspect of our people, of our country, that the government is responsible for, and we should be wanting to protect those within our country. And you can't do that with people in the country where you don't know who they are, where they are, what their thoughts are, what they've done in the past, what they're going to do moving forwards. But with regards to some Christian churches, some of them have become more, I guess the word that we would use is more woke. And so, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised that some of the churches would take a slightly different view. But obviously there are still churches that are more aligned with how the Bible was first written and how we would be expecting the Christianity faith to be upheld.
Do you see UKIP and political parties as a sort of church?
Do I see them as a church?
Yeah, the fact that a political party has got a congregation, it's got a following, it's got a code and a creed and everything else that people can look to. I mean, do you see it as a sort of quasi-church?
Well, that's a strange way of looking at it. I can't say I've ever looked at any political party as a church or anything like that, no. Mm. No, I don't think so.
I understand you do psychic readings, tarot cards, that kind of thing. How do you get into all that?
Although I was brought up in a Christian faith, I also believed quite heavily in spirits. I'd seen spirits. And there were other things when, you know, I was able to hear certain things, feel certain things. I'm very good at understanding other people, you know, what they're feeling, what they're going through. And so I think it just came quite naturally. And I know that some people from a religious perspective would say that that's not necessarily a Christian thing to do, but different parts of Christianity would look at it differently. And obviously I have my own thoughts on that, but basically I just was able to see things, hear things. And at that time, it was something that I wanted to explore to find out why, like, you know, why could I do that? Why was I able to, why can I see a ghost and you can't? So it was something that I just wanted to explore a little more myself.
So you have psychic powers then?
I would say that I have been able to look into certain things that people might say has a psychic element to it. Yeah.
Mm, okay. You organised a UKIP demonstration in Thanet the other week, but the turnout was pretty low, a handful of people at most. Do you think that kind of sums up UKIP's prospects as it stands as a political party?
Not at all. UKIP has definitely, it's like rebranding. And there are many different businesses out there as well that, you know, they rebrand and you have to grow that following again. We've got a lot of more quiet support. I'm very confident, actually, that there's more support than there was on that day.
You've got a pretty sort of charismatic leader. He's that goes a long way to sort of, you know, getting the message across, doesn't it?
He's offering something different. Mm. And I think when people can open their eyes and see that, that will also add to the amount of following and how we can grow as a party. I mean, on the left, you've got Jeremy Corbyn, for instance. He is an activist, always has been. And he, over the years, has definitely gathered himself quite a following of people because he brings something different. And here on the right, I don't think really, when you look at other parties, you see many of them that are willing to stand there and be an activist and be frontline with their supporters saying, well, I'm too not happy with this. A lot of them are more happy to go to private events, you know, sit there drinking wine and do all the fancy things. Well, we're saying actually, it's not just about that, about getting out there and showing your support. So I think that we'll definitely grow in numbers support-wise because of him and how he goes about it. But we've got support behind the scenes. It's just very difficult for people to put themselves out there. I mean, you only have to look at what I get on my page sometimes and the amount of people that are more than happy to, you know, lay into you because you've been seen or because they've heard you say something. And for a lot of people, they don't want that drama. They don't want that hassle. You know, it's going to affect their family as well as them. So it's very difficult to maybe get people to be seen with you. But there's definitely a lot of support.
Amelia Randall, thank you very much indeed for your time today. Thanks for coming in to have a chat with us.
Thank you.
As we heard earlier, Rachel Reeves was in Dartford on Monday to talk about her plans to make the delivery of the Lower Thames Crossing as speedy as possible. The Labour government says that it is committed to, quote, back the builder, not the blockers, by speeding up judicial review and limiting the number of them. There will be specialist judges with expertise in planning to cut delays and stop the unnecessary time wasting in court. The Lower Thames Crossing, which will have a significant proportion of private investment, is scheduled to finish in 2034 at a cost of $10 billion. 9 years from today, Dan, is that achievable?
Well, it certainly is, in theory, achievable. Plenty of countries actually manage to get things built not too long after they say they'll build them. But Britain has a particular problem in that it tends not to do that. And at least the government have caught on to one thing, which is a big part of why that's the case, is the successive British governments have basically created a legal and regulatory environment designed specifically to stop themselves from being able to do things. There's infinite judicial reviews, endless amounts of paperwork, endless sort of legal bureaucracy involved in the planning process, which plenty of countries manage to build good and safe and high quality and expensive infrastructure without subjecting themselves to that kind of thing. The question is, even though they realise this, does the British state have the have the means and the political will to do what is necessary to actually get things built, which is, for example, stuff like overriding judges, blocking the right of environmental groups to appeal. And is the government going to do that? I doubt it, despite all of the talk.
Really? Yeah, that's interesting. Rob, I mean, you take the view that, you know, it's in the pipeworks. You might as well get on with it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think as Dan sort of references, there is kind of a wide perception that Britain can't really build these things anymore. And that's incredibly frustrating to people. So if Labour can somehow get around to cutting through that and get these projects, at least get work started on them, to say, look, you know, we're not being held up, you know, like HS2 was, and actually start things, get the ball rolling, I think that would do a lot. You know, people would say that malaise that a lot of people feel would certainly go away. And I think I always think with big projects like this, if you get them completed, a lot of these sort of complaints, like, oh, what's the point of this? Why are we doing this? That a lot of people raise goes away, because then you've got it and people see the benefits. I mean, where I'm from is the Humber Bridge, which cost adjusted for...
Very, very famous bridge.
Yeah, adjusted, bigger than the Golden Gate Bridge. Adjusted for... It is. Adjusted for inflation, it's sort of £450 million it cost. It still hasn't paid off the money it borrowed to build it in the first place. But if you ask anybody around where I'm from, should we not have bothered? I mean, it's a ridiculous suggestion. It's done loads for both the economy, but also, you know, just getting around.
Yeah. Well, the LTC, the whole point of having it is it's going to take a lot of pressure off the Dartford crossings, which are completely overloaded. Anybody gets stuck in traffic there will know what it's like. And it's a different route into the other side of the Thames. And it takes you to all the different parts. So it actually will help to sort of distribute a lot of that freight that's coming in and out of, coming out of Europe and into the wider world. Nicky, Laura Sullivan is trying to get a slice of cash from the tolls that will eventually be reaped
She is. Yeah, and I really hope the government is listening. I've been reporting in the Gravesend area since 1995, and talk about this has taken up a very large chunk of my career, and clearly it's going to continue to do so. I mean, for a long time, many people in the Gravesend area hoped this wouldn't happen, and probably some of them still don't think it will. Now, I don't think there's going to be any kind of U-turn on that, but the government is saying completion still isn't likely to happen until 2034, and in reality, do we really think that date is going to be met? I don't know, maybe I'm just being pessimistic. But having said that, the government is pushing to get this going, and that puts Lauren Sullivan in a difficult position. She's got her party wanting to plough on, but many of her constituents unhappy with what lies ahead. But it does give her time. I mean, she knows that the best thing that she can do right now is try to soften the blow and make sure that from as early as possible, agreements are put in place to ensure that the people who live near that route are going to get the best possible outcome. And the obvious and hopefully achievable option is to make sure a chunk of the toll money from the crossing goes directly into something locally. Now, Lauren is calling for that money to go towards funding to return the Gravesend to Tilbury Ferry, which is a great idea, as providing that extra service would also encourage people who don't use a vehicle to use an alternative route to cross the River Thames. But we're still talking about something that's years away from opening, and people want the ferry back now. So although I think the idea of using the toll money to subsidise it is a good one in the long term, I think there needs to be another idea to bring back the ferry service sooner rather than later. But absolutely, yes, local people should see the benefit from a percentage of this toll money, and Lauren should get that agreed as soon as she can. And I also think that people who live nearby should be given discounts in the same way those who live near the Dartford crossing do at the moment.
And perhaps even if there's money available, there's cash up front, there's 560 odd million pounds to get it going, why they can't take a slice of that off even long before the thing is built. So
absolutely.
Okay, listen, now before we go, we're just about to bring in senior editor Matt Ramson to talk about some changes to Kent Online's politics coverage.
Hi, Simon. Thanks for that. As many listeners already know, we have a special Kent and Medway politics section on Kent Online. And I'm pleased to say we've recently added a new MP section to this. We're going to be including regular columns from all our MPs, our men and women at Westminster, and finding out what they've been up to.
Who have we got signed up so far then?
So far, pretty much all of them have signed up and said that they'll be keen to do this. We've already featured columns from Dover's Mike Tapp and from Ashford's Sojan Joseph. We've also invited Medway Council leader Vince Maple and KCC leader Lyndon Kim-Kerran to take part too.
And where can people find this coverage?
It's very easy to find. Just go to kentonline.co.uk/kent/politics.
Okay, that's your lot this week. Thanks to Dan, Nikki and Robert for their contributions and to our special guest, Amelia Randall. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage, and you can also sign up for our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.